This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The New World Report with Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College. Nicaragua, darkness visible. Since the recent so-called election, Managua has been ruled by the same very strong hand, Mr. Ortega and his wife, since many years standing. You can see the denunciation of the Managua-Nicaragua regime by the United States and other democracies in the region. However, looking past the politics, I learned from reporting in Science magazine that the Ortegas have been brutal towards the universities in Nicaragua, closing them or consolidating them or intimidating them and driving scholars out of Managua, out of their university settings, who become pilgrims. Professor, this is a fresh story to me because I've been focusing on the politics of different capitals across the region. And that prevents me from going any deeper into themes such as scholarship. Is this something you've seen before in countries that are troubled, or is Nicaragua unique in suppressing and intimidating scholars?
John, although the details of this are somewhat unique to the Nicaraguan case, the story is a longtime story that we saw with the repression of thinking during the Cold War and more recently, of course, in Cuba and in Venezuela and elsewhere. And it goes back to the problem that authoritarian regimes and totalitarian regimes are threatened by centers of independent thought, whether that is the media, which oftentimes becomes subject to economic and legal attacks and often physical repression. And then, of course, universities. And so what we see in Nicaragua is that it was university students who helped to lead the protests that almost toppled the regime in April 2018 and which continued. And certainly now the understanding that those private universities, of which there are still about 40 in Nicaragua, represent a threat, at least ideologically, that goes beyond the threat that were presented by the political leaders and presidential contenders, of which, as you recall, you had almost 40 of those put in jail. And so most recently, what's happened with eight private universities is that the regime has closed them, arguably with respect to technical violations, and has then confiscated their goods and said that it would offer to basically take the students who were at those universities, basically recreate universities, which it would then run and give those students a more state-controlled doctrinal education. It's interesting that about 2,000 university students have already fled because of not only the repression of thought, but also just because of the conditions, the risks that they are put under, either because of protesters or because of the work that they do. Certainly the laws such as the national security law in which you have to label yourself as a foreign agent if you're taking any type of financial help from an international organization has been a problem that limits university collaboration. We've already had some cases in which, for example, Florida International University and Michigan State University, which had operations in conjunction with Nicaraguan partner universities, were shut down again by the government. So really, it's an attempt to suppress thought, especially thought by that segment who generates ideas and leadership, which is most respective. So it's really another sad chapter in the consolidation of authoritarian control by Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo in Nicaragua.
I read from the Science magazine report because it's especially revealing about how dictatorships, strongmen respond to transparency. Researchers say they must be particularly cautious about any work that could be interpreted as political. Research on democracy, gender, human rights, hard hit. A social scientist says his group can no longer conduct surveys and publishes under pseudonyms if mentioning government abuses. Several researchers who commented requested anonymity, fearing retaliation. Research about COVID-19 in Nicaragua faces obstacles as the government has understated case numbers and fired doctors and public health experts who express concern about the crisis. It's striking to me, Professor, because sometimes dictatorships turn into dystopian romances. They fear transparency. They fear the facts about their own healthcare system. They fear polling, which may or may not give them an understanding of how to be a leader or how to respond to exogenous events. It's as if the Ortegas only have interest in one thing, which is total control and no, what do they fear, dissent? You can't say a scholar doing a poll is a dissenter. You'd have to say it. These are facts. They're not falsehoods.
You're absolutely right, John. And this has traditionally been the problem with all authoritarian totalitarian regimes, that it's not about the facts, but it's about a narrative that permits the continuation of state control. And so Nicaraguan universities represent a source of essentially authoritative discourse that can threaten the regime. And you indicated some of the problematic areas. If you have polls that show that perhaps the Ortegas are not as popular, or if you show that there are a significant amount of unreported COVID deaths, which go against the state line, which it has achieved by basically not testing for COVID. Those type of things provide potentially authoritative challenges to the regime, which can affect the opinion of people and cause people to think badly of the regime. And so, you know, essentially it's, suppressing any type of discourse, whether right or wrong, that could challenge the line that the regime wishes to propagate.
I tell a story of a report I was able to find with a paleontologist and a botanist, a combination, paleobotanist, about the neotropical jungle that dates to the dinosaur death that we call the Amazon. That's where the Amazon, that vast triple layer canopy, comes from 66 million years ago. He was in Italy when I spoke with him, but my memory is that he'd come from Venezuela, living in Panama, and then had traveled to Italy on a grant or a series of grants to do investigation of the neotropical forest and the riches of the earth. And at the time, I thought, well, he's a pilgrim. He goes where the grants are. But I'm beginning to think that scholarship in Latin America has been badly damaged by years of on-again, off-again authoritarianism. And that it's impossible to know how many people have had their careers destroyed or have had to rearrange their lives so that they're not able to pursue their dreams because the politics don't suit scholarship. Is this something you hear often, Professor, from scholars? I don't mean in themes that are vaguely political. I mean paleontology. I understand you could say the dinosaurs are politically active, but we call them birds. But in any event, studying the Amazon forest's origins is not going to threaten anybody's regime.
You make an excellent point, John. And the real issue is that scientific scholarship with the notion of objectivity and discoverable truth and scientists themselves are sources of authority. And any source of authority other than the regime represents a threat to that regime. It's interesting. I followed the deterioration of Venezuela since I used to do work there in the early 2000s and actually even going back to the late 1990s and seeing university, well-respected universities like Universidad Simón Bolívar, for example, and some of their professors who were forced out, even places that were traditionally aligned with the left, like Universidad Central de Venezuela, even some of the leftist dissenters being forced out. And historically, throughout the region, this has been a problem with, again, authoritarian, totalitarian regimes. And it's often not just laws against the universities. Oftentimes, it's undercutting them financially, undercutting their grants, undercutting their scholarships. Oftentimes, it is putting the professors themselves to feel that their physical security is at risk. And they're also, with the deterioration in places like Venezuela, it's often very hard to make a living as a professor as well. So, for example, in Venezuela, a professor or technical personnel would make, with inflation, if they didn't have access to illicit dollars from the illicit economy or other things, as little as $10 a month. And Venezuela is not that cheap of a place to live. The economy has become largely dollarized. And so, you just can't make a living as a professor doing your paleontology work or other work on $10 a month. And so, that's pushed many out there. Now, in all importance, it's fair enough to say there are a lot of other problems with Latin American universities that come from an excess focus on sociology and liberal arts and politicization and arguably the role, ironically, of the left within the university. A lot of problems that we're familiar with also in U.S. universities. universities, but specifically to authoritarian regimes. It's ironic that those same universities that oftentimes seek to promote a left social justice agenda, at the end of the day, when you have populists that consolidate control, it's those independent voices of science and authority that themselves are, you know, put at risk.
Let's speak of an authoritarian regime that out to the reporting has driven away its scholars, its intellectuals, its ambitious young people. Venezuela, of course. The surprising news is that Venezuela is doing very well in terms of growth. Thank you very much. Why? Because it is a natural resource of fossil fuels and other important elements for the development of the 20th century. I read from an Economist report in these last days. On April 22nd, a ban on Russian oil imports will come into the effect on the United States. That has happened. One of the countries that could benefit is Venezuela. According to Credit Suisse, its economy, Venezuela, is expected to grow in real terms by 20% this year. It's growing from a low base, but 20% is a lot. This will be driven wholly by the oil industry. The banks expect petroleum output to increase by more than a fifth. And, Professor, you recall the reporting on Chavez was that he let the oil industry deteriorate with people fleeing or people no longer responding to him. At one point, I remember him militarizing the oil industry. I think he sent the army in or something strange. But that was Chavez. This is Maduro now. At the same time, the United States is looking to Caracas in some fashion for help with the worldwide damage to fossil fuel production because of war in Ukraine and other problems. The report at The Economist goes on to say, three American officials met Mr. Maduro in an encounter he described as, quote, respectful. This has to do with the Biden administration looking for offsets for Russian oil imports. So what is the general opinion about Maduro's regime? Is it being saved by the war in Ukraine, this growth, and the request from the U.S. that the oil from Venezuela is again welcome on the world market? I understand here that the U.S. has refineries that were built for Venezuela oil, do not run as well on the Saudi oil, the high-tech stuff, because it's not thick like Venezuela. So we're waiting for, or we're looking for, developing Venezuela oil. Does that mean Maduro is saved? What is the general opinion?
John, first of all, it's important to put the economic figures in perspective. If I have a dollar a day to feed my family and suddenly I have $2 a day, the goodness of my situation has just doubled, but I've still got very, very serious problems. And so in Venezuela, where oil production in a country that used to produce 3.1 million barrels of oil a day, which was talking realistically before Chavez of going up to as much as 6 million barrels a day, not too long ago, Venezuela is down to about 300,000 barrels a day. I mean, almost nothing. Now, initially, some essentially sanctions busting activities by the Iranians bringing in some of their refined petroleum products to swap, and others who were essentially refining oil illicitly under other names, that helped get Venezuela's oil production technically up to about 800,000 barrels per day. The other major thing that happened is that you had the skyrocketing of the price of oil, as we've seen here in the United States, which meant that even while the Venezuelan oil had to sell it at a discount, the amount of money that Venezuela could get from its oil dramatically increased as well. And so all of those things collectively meant that in the numbers, it made it look like Venezuela was doing wondrous things. The other thing that Venezuela did is they essentially gave up on all of the destructive price controls. And they said, OK, we're going to permit the dollarization of the economy. Now, that works well, ironically, because there are so many narco dollars and so many dollars from remittances sent by these 7 million Venezuelans who have left the country because of a lack of opportunity that, if you could get access to dollars, either because you were involved in illicit activity activity or because you had family from outside sending you dollars, you did okay. And that made the Venezuelan numbers look better and the GDP look a lot better. And of course, what's happening now is a policy that some of us have deep, deep disagreements with, in which you have Juan Gonzalez and NSC and others, you know, seeking to negotiate with the Maduro regime. One part of that has been talking about giving a general license, probably to Chevron, to increase its oil production. That could increase it from about 800,000 barrels a day to about 1.2 million barrels a day. Chevron would probably promise that that would go to the U.S. And not to repay Russian and Chinese debt. But so at the end of the day, you're talking about, yes, that U.S. policy has increased things farther. And also that is signaled to others like the Russians, like the Chinese, that if the U.S. is working with the Venezuelans, then it's safe for the Russians and Chinese. And so Venezuela is still in bad, bad shape. The economy is just in is just disastrous. But that combination of international oil prices, some increase in production, some smuggling and help from the Iranians, and now this Christmas gift that the administration has provided, probably through Chevron, really is dramatically changed things. Still hasn't solved that for the 7 million Venezuelans who've been forced to leave their country, which has been economically destroyed. But they've maybe gone from hypothetically, a dollar to eat for the day to $2 to eat for the day. But things are still pretty bad.
Professor Avenelis, U.S. Army War College. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.